welcome to Tuned to Yesterday, delivering programs from radio's golden age. I'm your host, Mark Levonier. Coming up in this hour, true history. Later on, we hear all about author Damon Runyon on the Hallmark Hall of Fame. But right now, it's American Adventure, the 21st broadcast in this NBC series, heard on December 29th, 1955. The story, Paint the Big Canvas, tells us the tale of the planning of Washington, D.C.
This is American Adventure, a study of man in the New World, what he believes and what he lives by. Written by John Ely, directed by John Clayton, American Adventure is produced and recorded by the Communications Center of the University of North Carolina, Earl Wynn, director. Tonight's program is about the founding of Washington, D.C., and there's quite a story to be told about it, and about Pierre L'Enfant, the French designer who planned it. For L'Enfant was an unusual man. We will pick up his story when he is at a meeting called by George Washington, at which he is to show the plans for the capital city. Pierre L'Enfant has come to the meeting after having given long thought to the task at hand, but without any plans at all. This we know, and L'Enfant knows it. And Washington and Jefferson and the others are soon to find it out.
I assure you, gentlemen, the Major will present to us a beautiful and finished plan. Come up and take the floor, Major.
Yes, sir. gentlemen, it's quite an honor to be here, but I didn't expect anyone else would. I do want to thank you, Mr. President, for those kind remarks.
Not at all. Suppose you spread your map out here on the top of the desk, Major, and get on with it.
Yes, sir. I suppose you'll notice that here is the river, the Potomac.
Mm-hmm.
And this is Rock Creek here, and this is Georgetown.
I see. Where is the new city, Major?
I don't have it, sir. Not on paper. You see, this is a terribly complex problem if it's to be done right.
Well, do you have any idea about the plan for the city, Major?
Oh, yes, sir. In my mind, Mr. Jefferson.
Uh-huh. Where is the Capitol building to be placed?
There is a hill which could convey a broad countryside and perhaps a Potomac, sir.
Why, that's miles to the Potomac.
Yes, sir. 2 miles. But with a park in between.
A 2-mile park?
Yes, sir.
And where would the president's palace go, next to the Capitol?
No, sir. There's another hill here, about a mile or so away.
But, Major, how can you get from one to another?
By carriage, sir.
I am quite aware that a man can go from one place to another by carriage. But why should we go to the expense of building such a street when the two buildings can be placed together?
It is not a street, sir. It is an avenue.
And what is the difference?
By my plan, sir, a street is 160 feet wide, whereas an avenue is wider.
Mr. President, with all due respect to this gentleman, I have never heard of such a plan. Now, I saw Mr. Jefferson's proposed plan, which was very beautiful and certainly reasonable. Let's be reasonable, gentlemen.
In trying to design a city, gentlemen,
the plan Tom Jefferson drew, that was a city, wasn't it, Major L'Enfant?
Certainly, but it has been known for centuries that you can mark off trees in one direction and cross them with trees going in another and have a city, but there is no art to that.
Well, Jefferson, would you care to comment?
A 5-year-old boy might make such a plan by accident.
You'll have to pardon me for laughing, Tom.
To build a truly beautiful city, you must plan it with the land in mind. The hills, streams, rivers, ridges, forests. And by sensible use of these assets of nature, establish a truly beautiful city. A work of art.
Tom, would you care to say anything?
Now, George, I'm not a designer of cities.
Yes, I just heard Major L'Enfant discuss that.
What was said about my plan, though said somewhat more dramatically than I should hope necessary, Monsieur L'Enfant.
I'm indeed apologetic, Monsieur Jefferson. My temper is so...
Of course, Monsieur. But actually, by choosing a level piece of ground, one may not, to be sure, have so dramatic a city, but a city more practical, serviceable. One that is also beautiful and at reasonable expense.
Except that now, right now, we have a chance which no nation has ever given itself. The chance to build its capital city by plan rather than just by need. Oh, it's well enough to say that the city could be changed at another time, but it could not, Mr. President, because it would not. It is now that we must say here, by these marches, we will demonstrate our fate in the future of this country. We will show you the breadth of our nation and the width of our avenues and the length of our parks. We will cause to rise here in our day the beginnings of the city. Oh, too big for us, true, but not too large for our grandchildren. Oh, don't you see, gentlemen, I tell you, we must envision this nation as it is to be, when all nations of the world, yes, even England and France and Spain, will stand and salute her and say, look what brave men have done. Look at that, rising from the Atlantic, a nation free. How can an American plan for less than greatness, gentlemen?
Rarely before have I heard another voice my own sentiments so beautifully.
Thank you, Mr. President.
Thank you for your advice, gentlemen. There are some other matters I must attend to, so excuse me, please.
I wish you luck, monsieur.
Thank you, Mr. Jefferson.
I think you will design for us a beautiful city.
I hope so, sir.
I assure you we share your dream of a great nation. But the greatness of the nation I see, sir, is judged not by her cities, nor by the buildings of her government, but by the degree of freedom given her people from their government and from their neighbors. My vision is not so much of a nation as it is a man. Not of America so much as it is of the American. Free even to be wrong. Free to disagree. Free to condemn his government if he wishes or his neighbor if he dares. Now, that is a dream as great as your city.
My plan is not to determine the extent of government, Mr. Jefferson, but only to plan a city which will be flexible enough to serve whatever size government may evolve.
I understand that, and I wish you luck, monsieur.
Thank you, sir.
It was not long before the plan was completed and work began on the capital city. And the people of Georgetown and the surrounding area looked with amazement as the men began clearing Constitution Avenue, with other avenues for Delaware, Massachusetts, the Carolinas, Maryland, Georgia, and the rest of the states of the Great 13. And some of the people were impressed by the tremendous expanses in the plan of L'Enfant. Others were unimpressed.
Mud hole, that's what he's a-making. Got so many mud holes you can't drive a wagon through in less than 3 hours.
A village of magnificent distances, that's what it is.
Village monumental.
Town of houses without streets and streets without houses.
So I saw this Frenchman sitting there on his horse watching the men clear, and I went up to him and I said, pardon me, sir, and I pointed to some workers a couple hundred feet away and said, could you tell me if this here avenue is going to be longer than from here to them men, or is that the end of it? Well, his eyebrows got heavier and his eyes got smaller, like a devil he was. And then he said calm-like, that ain't the length, Monsieur, that's the width. That's the width, he says. Down there a couple hundred yards away, and that's the width.
They say there is to be a wide avenue that goes from the President's Palace to the Capitol building. An avenue over a mile long, and you can see one building from the other. They call this a Pennsylvania Avenue, and it will doubtless become the Avenue of State. Except that it is inconceivable that this tiny nation can ever afford the tremendous expense of paving such a long stretch of roadway. And carriage traffic will be impossible in the wintertime.
Mr. L'Enfant, please be reasonable with us.
I am trying to be reasonable, sir.
For weeks, you have consistently refused to cooperate with this commission.
I have not refused to cooperate.
We are, after all, the legal commission appointed by the president.
I also am appointed by the president.
To work under us.
To design and build a city, the best city that I can.
Under us.
Why, sir, under heaven, the best city that I can.
I will tell you bluntly, L'Enfant, that in the future you will cooperate with us, reasonably and honestly, or you will certainly be removed, even in spite of President Washington.
You do not like my work?
It is not a question of liking or disliking.
I understand. It is a question of size, is it not?
Not necessarily, but of organization.
The president's advisors have said they like my city. But then, do they not come to you and say it is too big, it is too expensive, and L'Enfant must be controlled?
Well, to assert that there has been no criticism of the proportions of this city is, well, is to deny what the whole world knows.
The truth is, they would cut my city down to their size.
What about this waterfall anyway, L'Enfant?
Waterfall? I know of no waterfall.
I hear you've planned a waterfall out in that cow pasture you're clearing before the Capitol building.
Cow pasture? That is a park.
It's a cow pasture, if I ever saw one.
A park.
Well, all I know is that cows are grazing out there, and there's room for 1,000 more.
And a waterfall you mentioned. It is not a waterfall. It is a cascade.
Mr. L'Enfant, we are not interested in words, but in facts, figures, prices, reasons. Now, this cascade, I understand, is to be 150 feet long and 40 feet high. Is that true?
It is.
Now, just in case somebody might ask one of us commissioners what in the devil we are building such a cascade for, and where in the devil we are to gather this vast amount of water, would you mind telling us?
It is to be a focal point laid a few blocks south of the Capitol building, and the water is to be brought in from the sources of Tiber Creek.
Now, I hope all of us have memorized that answer, because I'm sure we'll have need of it in the coming days.
You say this cascade is not to be in front of the Capitol building?
It is to be at the intersection of North Carolina and New Jersey Avenue.
Make a note of that, somebody. Well, now, that's fine, Major. There may be one more question that we'll be asked. How much is this cascade going to cost?
I do not know, monsieur.
Do you think it would be possible to construct a capital city which did not have such a cascade?
Yes, monsieur, but not for this country.
I anticipated that feeling on your part.
Is that all, monsieur?
No, it isn't all. The lots are to be sold come Friday. Are they all marked off for the auction?
Yes, sir.
Will you attend the sale?
Yes.
You will bring a copy of the plan with you?
Why?
To show to the people who are buying the lots. We can't expect them to buy a pig and a poke.
Monsieur, I do not know this pig and a poke, but I do know what I have said. That no group should see this plan until copies have been mailed to all sections of this country, so that all who are interested may have equal chance to buy choice lots. That is my position, sir.
The position of this commission is that you will attend the sale, and there you will show the buyers your plan so that the buyers can tell where these lots are located in relation to the president's palace, the Capitol, various cascades, waterfalls, pastures, parks, avenues, equestrian statues, canals, plaques, and mud ditches.
Yes, there is nothing else, gentlemen. Good afternoon.
Of all the insolent, temperamental, impossible imbeciles, where in the world did George Washington locate him?
One feature of L'Enfant's plan was that from the Capitol building you might look down Pennsylvania Avenue and see the President's Palace, which of course we today call the White House. Halfway between the two, at the point of several springs, L'Enfant planned to build five impressive fountains. It was all very well. But unfortunately, Daniel Carroll of Duddington, being sure that Pennsylvania Avenue would never develop to any extent, proceeded to build his house at the place of these springs on a foundation which had been laid before the federal city was started. L'Enfant warned him that completing the house was inadvisable. But Daniel Carroll and his wife wanted a new brick home. They built it. And when L'Enfant sent word for them to tear it down, they rather pointedly refused.
So, they will not tear it down themselves?
They indicated that that was their general feeling at the moment, Pierre.
What did you tell them?
I don't know, Pierre. Just tell me what to do when the laborers get the avenue cleared down to the house. Just tell me that.
What would you do if the house were a tree?
I would be astonished.
If the house were a tree, would you not cut it down?
If you say so, Pierre, I suppose I would.
Then take the house down, that is all.
All right, Pierre. And the commissioners?
They must not know until we are on our way. I will be out of town and write them a letter. We'll plan that later.
Yes, sir.
Be sure when you tear down the house to have good carpenters who will do as little damage to the material as possible. But tear it down, Roberto. Tear it down.
But the commissioners were notified of L'Enfant's plans, and hardly had the workmen begun tearing down the Carroll home when the commissioners stopped the operation. Pierre, many miles away purchasing a quarry from which the white stone for the Capitol and President's House were to come, heard soon enough of this order. And with his continental anger fully aroused, he wore out one of the best horses in America getting back to the sprawling Capitol City. He reined up in front of the Carroll House and marshaled his workmen.
I want you to take the furniture out of the house and set it under the trees. And I want the carpenters and masons to go to work at once to take off the roof and bring down the sides. And if the commissioners do not like it, let them go to Philadelphia and talk to President Washington.
So the men went to work tearing down the Carroll House. Good American laborers who've never torn down a house before. Fact is, not many houses had ever been torn down in this whole continent before. Good masons are awkward when taking apart a solid masonry wall.
and carpenters moved slowly when taking molding from around the fireplace. But down came the house, down to the foundation, down to the cellar where the wine would have kept cool in summer, down to the dried tears of Daniel Carroll's wife, down to the line that was now clearly drawn between the commissioners and Pierre Charles Lanfant.
Sit down, Mr. Lanfant.
Thank you.
I called you to my office to state, Mr. Lanfant, that the commission is displeased with your recent action.
In my letter to President Washington, I made clear that my authority...
I am aware of your letter. We hope that you are aware of President Washington's letter to you, stating that your actions are to be under the control of this commission. Is that your only comment?
I have here some plans for the winter work.
Mr. Lanfant, are there any more houses that are standing in the way of your plan?
Yes, sir. The house of Notley Young must come down.
Oh, look.
But it's at the end of a street, and perhaps 7 years or so would be time enough.
We must write Mr. Young and relieve his mind about this.
I have already written him.
You have written him? Who are you to write him?
Why, sir, I can write well enough.
My commission should write him, not you.
I have the plan here for the winter work.
Major, with this attitude, there isn't going to be any winter work.
Sir?
The activities of the Federal City are approaching a standstill. This commission is going to have authority over you if we must stop work on the Federal City entirely. We are going to have authority over you.
A few weeks later, as tension continued, L'Enfant's men were discharged, and L'Enfant's overseer was imprisoned for breaking the new rules of the commission. The work on the Federal City was stopped.
President Washington has called a special meeting of his advisors, Monsieur L'Enfant. He told me to talk to you and report back. With all work stopped, laborers discharged, construction at an absolute standstill, and you and the commissioners writing letters about each other...
I've never dealt in personalities, Monsieur Lee.
Be that as it may, I'm here to state that the President feels this entire matter can and must be worked out. But no reconciliation can be reached if you refuse to work under the commission. As law of Congress directs, you must.
I do not object to the commission, but only to the commissioner.
These commissioners will not be removed, I promise you. Then surely your grievances are not so great that...
Great! They are beyond great! When they take my plan without my permission and give it to a surveyor to make changes, a man who knows nothing about cities, they take my plan and twist it into size. Then when they have twisted it, mailed copies of it around the world, and the surveyor has his name put on the design rather than me.
Without question, Major, that is a serious grievance. Perhaps a personal apology
from... Oh, that is not my main grievance. It is a very great grievance, but not the greatest.
Then, please, what is the greatest? I must board the next stage to get back in time for the cabinet meeting.
I do not know my main reason.
I beg your pardon?
I said I have no idea to tell you.
But am I to appear before the cabinet and say, gentlemen, what am I to say?
I don't know. It is difficult to explain even to myself, but it comes to this. I am asked to design a city. I do. Something beautiful evolved in my mind. How can I put it all on paper? I see it evolving, not as a finished work. And even such things that I see will not go on paper without becoming words, thoughts, indexes, figures. You understand?
Perhaps.
But in my mind, I see the beginnings of a beautiful city. So then, these country gentlemen look at my city plan and they see nothing of beauty. They see only words, sketches, lines, budgets, indexes. And then they say, change this, do away with this, narrower here, a bit too much here for our money. They are changing figures on paper, but actually they are changing the features of my city. My plan is no longer pretty. It becomes ugly. And then I say, no, you cannot do this. And they say, why not? We are authorized by Congress. And then it comes time for me to speak in rebuttal, but I cannot. Do you understand?
Not in the slightest.
You see, I am remarkably clear, and nobody understands.
Major, I think you may be saying something, but... What?
I cannot explain it any better.
But what are you explaining? After all, most of the commission's criticism comes down to your disregard for their authority. Not all this.
My father always said to me, Pierre, use a big canvas. Do not paint except on a big canvas.
Why, sir, there have been paintings on small canvases which are rather good, it seems to me.
My father painted war scenes. I have no doubt that he killed more Frenchmen in his paintings than all France's enemies. Frenchmen were brave in his paintings. They were fierce. They were powerful. They were confident. They were victorious. Even in the battles with the history books that they lost, my father painted them victorious in defeat. Oh, I love the spirit in their faces.
I wonder if we could come back to the subject, Major.
I have heard critics come to my father and say, look here now, we aren't all that good, you know. We French, really. And my father would be upon that stepladder painting his soldiers on a big canvas, and he would peer down at them and say, we will be what we envision.
Major L'Enfant, I would like to hear more about your famous father, but at another time. What can I tell Mr. Washington?
You might say, L'Enfant demands a big canvas and an opportunity to say in a city what his father says in battles, that this nation can be what it envisions.
Am I to go back to see George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, Alexander Hamilton, and other founders of this nation, and tell them that you send word that the United States can become whatever it envisions? You are addressing, sir, through me, the final authorities on the vision of the United States. Now, sir, please tell me what you have to say about the commission. Tell me what to tell them.
Tell them that I am tired. I am absolutely clear, but I am not understood. I have tried to explain myself, and I have succeeded only in that I have explained myself to myself, as I was clear to me long ago. I have said all I can say, and I have heard all that I want to hear about this matter. Tell them that.
Is that your word for General Washington? Believe me, sir, he is not a man to be played with.
Nor am I, monsieur.
He wants you to stay in your present capacity.
I will not officiate it by destruction of my work. Let him find someone else to love this city for him, to see mud roads as something other than they are, to nurse the city. Your stage will be loading soon, monsieur.
A letter from Tom Jefferson cleared up the entire matter by dismissing Pierre L'Enfant. Actually, there was no other possible course in the political turmoil which had arisen. But the plan of Pierre L'Enfant was followed nonetheless. Some changes have been made down through the years, many of which are now seen to be mistakes. But still, Washington is built around the plan of L'Enfant. And he's buried now in Arlington Cemetery, where he can look out over the city he designed. This man of the New World. This artist who saw everything en grand. Who painted only on the big canvas, who symbolized in a plan the greatness of the coming nation. And as you stand beside his grave, as perhaps you will someday, you will look out and see the monument that commemorates him. Lying there, stretching on the banks of the Potomac, on one of the largest of canvases, you will see the village monumental, the town of magnificent distances, the most beautiful city in America, Washington.
American Adventure is written by John Ely, directed by John Clayton, and is produced by the Communications Center of the University of North Carolina, Earl Wynn Director. The series is made possible by grants and aid from the Educational Television and Radio Center, an organization established by the Ford Foundation. In Paint the Big Canvas, the part of Pierre L'Enfant was played by Charles Hadley. Earl Wynn was Washington, John Bunnitz was the chairman of the commissioners, and Bill Waddell was Washington's assistant, Mr. Lear. Cast members in all American Adventure programs are students, professors, and townspeople of the University of North Carolina community, and American Adventure is produced and recorded on the campus at Chapel Hill. Tonight's program originated from WPTF in Raleigh, North Carolina. Thank you.
This is the NBC Radio Network.
American Adventure, on Tuned to Yesterday from December 29th, 1955 on NBC. You're listening to an hour of true history on Tuned to Yesterday. I'm your host, Mark Levanier. And now the Hallmark Hall of Fame is hosted by movie star Lionel Barrymore in the CBS broadcast from May 16th, 1954, starring another actor, Van Heflin, portraying author Damon Runyon.
A Hallmark card, when you care enough to send the very best. Tonight, from Hollywood, the makers of Hallmark cards bring you a true story from the life of Damon Runyon, starring Gene Fowler and Van Heflin, on the Hallmark Hall of Fame. Our distinguished host, Mr. Lionel Barrymore.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Hallmark Hall of Fame. Tonight, a true story from the life of Damon Runyon, reporter, columnist, and one of the greatest short story writers of modern times. And here to tell it, one of Damon Runyon's friends, the author and journalist and reporter, Gene Fowler. And to star in the role of Damon Runyon, Van Heflin. Now, here is Frank Goss.
A Hallmark card not only says what you want to say, the way you want to say it, it also tells your friends something about you. It shows that you're a thoughtful person, that you go to a fine store and personally select the right card. A Hallmark card testifies that you demand good taste, good design. And the Hallmark and crown on the back of the card shows that you care enough to send the very best. Lionel Barrymore appears by arrangement with MGM, producers of the Technicolor picture Flame in the Flesh, starring Lana Turner, Pierre Angeli, and Carlos Thompson. And now Mr. Barrymore brings you transcribed tonight's exciting story starring Van Heflin and Gene Fowler on the Hallmark Hall of Fame.
Kansas. His father, his grandfather, and his great-grandfather were editors and publishers of newspapers. When he was 12, the family moved to Pueblo, Colorado. Runyon was a shy, sensitive boy, and his ambition was to be a newspaper man. One summer, after he'd become a reporter on the Denver Post, he went to nearby El Dorado Springs on an assignment, and it was there that Damon Runyon met Gene Fowler.
I was 13 at the time and plenty impressed. And maybe Runyon was impressed, too, because some years later, after he'd gone east and made his mark, he sent for me and gave me my start on the New York American. Damon Runyon and I were friends for 43 years. But I'm not sure I ever really knew him. It seems to me only his readers knew him. The people who bought his short stories by the millions and paid countless dollars to see the motion pictures that were made of them. But for all his shyness, for all his sensitivity and vanity, the demon was a man with a heart. Well, we used to call him the demon because in his dignified manner he was anything but. Damon was a man who talked very little, but listened a great deal. And what he heard, he wrote. And what he wrote bore such interesting titles as Guys and Dolls, Blue Plate Special, The Old Doll's House, Little Miss Marker. Remember Shirley Temple in that one? And many, many others. And the locale of these stories? Well, it was always the same. Broadway. Damon Runyon's Broadway. That remarkable stretch of pavement between Columbus Circle and Times Square. And Damon Runyon wrote about it and made it come alive. But the story I want to tell you tonight wasn't written by Runyon. It's a story that actually happened to him, and one that I think tells more about the demon than any of us who knew him could tell. It began in Hollywood at a party. And to use a cliche, Damon was at the pinnacle of his career. Everybody's happy about a new Runyon picture they've just finished. That's Damon Runyon over there. Blonde man, rimless glasses, medium build. Always dressed like that. Dapper. Loved clothes. I think he must have owned 100 suits, 40 top coats.
When do you think you'll be going back to New York, Damon?
Oh, pretty soon, I guess.
Can't stay away from Broadway very long, can you?
I don't know. You can get used to anything if you try.
Are you used to California?
Well, I've been working on it very hard.
Well, we like you here, Damon. Wish we could get you to stay here all the time. We like you as much as those literary critics in England who say you're as important to American literature as Thackeray and Dickens are to theirs.
Yes, I read that.
Well, now, don't laugh it off. They mean it, and they're right. No one's ever written the way you do. You've given us a new style. The fact that we can make your stories into pictures is even better. I thought it went fine, Damon, just fine.
Yes, so did I.
And so does everybody here. Well, you should be smiling. Anything wrong?
No, no.
You sure? You look tired.
No, I'm all right. I think I'll be running along.
Well, the party's only started.
Well, these are my best working hours.
Okay, Damon. See you tomorrow?
Sure. Sure, I'll see you tomorrow.
This thing happened about 10 years ago during World War II. Runyon had been in the Spanish-American War as a soldier, the First World War as a correspondent, so he knew what war was like and he hated it. World War II found him on the home front. One thing he did was give Armed Forces Radio the right to use all of his stories on their broadcasts overseas free. Like most of us in those days, he did his job, wrote his daily column, and worried about things in general. That night, he was worried about a cocker spaniel named Nubbin. Runyon always seemed to have a dog or a cat or a cricket around for a pet, no matter where he happened to be. So this night, he went to see a veterinarian.
Yes. What's the matter, Doc?
Well, no wonder your dog doesn't feel too well, Mr. Runyon. Bad tonsils.
Do dogs have tonsils?
Oh, yes. And sometimes they get infected.
I'll have to take them out.
Operate?
Afraid so. Well, if there's nothing else to do, okay.
Don't worry, Mr. Runyon. We'll take good care of her.
Doctor.
Yes?
While you've got that little light in your hand, would you mind looking at my throat?
I'm a veterinarian, Mr. Runyon, not an M.D.
Well, my throat's been bothering me lately, too.
All right. Open, please.
Okay. You see anything?
Mr. Runyon, why don't you look up a good throat specialist?
Specialist?
As I say, this is a little out of my line, but if I were you, Mr. Runyon, I'd do that. I'd do it very soon.
Sounds like a Damon Runyon story, doesn't it? That Runyon should be sent to a doctor by a veterinarian. But let me say this for the record. It wasn't the first time Damon Runyon was warned. The demon was always too busy writing stories, covering sports, turning out his column. Finally, when he returned to New York, he decided to see a specialist.
Well, how do you feel? Pretty good. A little tired, maybe.
Mm-hmm. Now open wider. Mm-hmm. Okay.
How long does this go on?
We have to look before we can tell you anything. Do you want to climb up here a moment?
Okay.
Oh, open. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Been about 12 years since we took your tonsils out, huh?
Yeah, about 12 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
I remember one night I was sitting over in Lindy's with a fella named Swifty Morgan. And Deep Dish was there, too. We were talking about One-Eyed Conley. And, you know, the gate crasher? Well, as it turned out...
Runyon relaxed in the chair and talked to the doctor. Talked about Broadway and the people he knew and met there. About the years when he'd first come to New York from Denver. He talked about people like Grantland Rice and Jack Dempsey and John McGraw and half a hundred others he'd known who'd made great names.
By the way, doctor, what time is it?
Hmm? Oh, 6:10.
Well, am I finished?
Yeah, for the moment.
I better get out of here. I've got a column to write for tomorrow. Where's my coat?
Over there.
Well, what do you think?
I'd like to be sure, Damon.
Sure of what?
You remember when you had that tonsillectomy I told you then that you might have trouble with your throat later on. There's some delicate tissues in there, Damon. Not usual at all.
Do I have to buy a gargle?
No. No, but you can stop into the drugstore downstairs and have this filled.
Okay. Hey, look. Light's coming on.
Monday. 4 o'clock, Damon.
That's a beautiful sight, Broadway.
Damon?
Huh?
I'd like to have you drop in.
Well, okay, if you say so.
Damon, I can't tell about this yet, but I don't want you to be too surprised if I ask you to spend some time in the hospital when I see you Monday.
Hospital? What for?
Observation. This may be serious. Drop in, Damon.
Okay. Good night, Doc.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Sorry, nurse. Good night.
Good night, Mr. Runyon. From the lab, doctor.
Here's?
Yes, Mr. Runyon.
Lab, please. They're checking on this report you just sent up. Damon Runyon. Yeah. Just want to make sure. Bye.
Well, doctor?
There's no doubt about it. He has cancer.
In just a moment, we bring you the second act of the Hallmark Hall of Fame. And now Lionel Barrymore brings you the second act of our true story of Damon Runyon, narrated by Gene Fowler and starring Van Heflin.
The story of Damon Runyon. It seems that in all the many experiences he had lived and wrote about, the experience that came toward the end of his life was the one that showed the most of his life. The kind of man he was and the kind of things he did. Gene Fowler can tell you about it.
The brighter side. That's what Damon Runyon called the column he wrote every day. You know why he called it the brighter side? Because most newspaper columns were full of arguments or gossip. Not Damon Runyon's brighter side, no sir. You could pick it up and read it any day of the week. You might laugh, or you might cry, or you might do both. But whatever happened to you, you felt good about it. And that's what he wanted to do, make people feel good. After the doctors told Damon what he was in for, he checked into the Memorial Hospital and kept on writing his column, and there were visitors.
How soon do you think you'll be getting out, Damon?
Oh, not long now.
They have sure missed you around Lindy's. There is hardly no traffic in Gab around there after 3 a.m. without you.
Well, I mostly listen, you know that.
Not with your close friends. You have got the record as being able to stay up and talk longer than any living man.
I guess I'll have to give up the title.
What?
Yeah, I guess I'm going to have to give up gabbing.
But what is that?
I said I think I'll give up talking.
You are leaving the hospital pretty soon, are you not?
Yeah, but I have to be operated on first. This isn't exactly a sore throat I've got.
Damon, what is it?
Oh, maybe I do talk too much at that. Maybe that's why these doctors are going to take out my voice box. Yeah.
Damon?
That's what all the waiting's been about. I'll be glad when it's over and I can get out of here. Maybe then other people can get a word in edgewise. Well, what's the matter with you? I haven't got any kick coming. All over the world today, on every front, youngsters are being shot at. Look at me. I've lived a full life. They've been swell years. I've got no kick coming.
Damon, we are all for you. All of us. When does it happen?
Tomorrow. You'd better get on out of here. I've got a column to write yet tonight.
Sure.
Next time, I will bring a few of the boys.
He had his typewriter in the hospital room, the same one that had turned out all those famous stories about Spanish John and Little Isidore and Good Time Charlie and Harry the Horse and lots of others. It's a fact that once those stories were published, people along Broadway were actually trying to make themselves over into Runyon characters. But I've often wondered how Runyon felt getting his column out in the hospital that night.
Mr. Runyon, what's all this?
Well, you see, I have a column I have to write for my paper.
And the hat?
And, oh, well, that's my hat.
You really don't have to wear it in here.
No, I guess not.
Time for bed now, Mr. Runyon. Tomorrow's a big day.
These are my best working hours.
Bed.
Tell me something. Did you ever try to lay down in bed and go to sleep when you had a column to get out?
I've never had to try to get a column out, Mr. Runyon, but I have tried to talk some sense to patients around here.
Then you'll go far.
Mr. Runyon, the doctor says you must get this rest. It's very important. You need all your strength.
After this operation's over, I'm going to tell that doctor... I guess I won't tell him anything. All right, you win. Bed.
That's better. Now, come on.
Nurse.
Huh?
Can you leave the light on?
Oh, Mr. Runyon,
I kind of like bright lights.
All right, Mr. Runyon. For a little while. Good night.
Good night.
It's pretty hard to say what's on a man's mind when he's lying alone in a hospital room facing a thing like that. You can think about it, though, and you can try to guess. Maybe Damon just lay there and thought about all the years and of all the people he'd met in all those years and all the things he'd seen and reported, football games, political speeches, prize fights, trials. But this night, before the operation there in the hospital, listening to the traffic outside his window, Damon Runyon had an idea for a different sort of story. And in this column he wrote that night, he imagined he had a visitor. A visitor who ordinarily wears black and whose appearance terrifies most people, death. But to Runyon, the visitor came in a white flannel suit. And he said...
Hello.
And the demon imagined himself facing death and replying to him, in Runyonese, naturally...
Oh, hello. Hello, hello, hello. I was not expecting you... I have not looked at the red board lately and did not know that my number was up. If you will hand me my KD and my coat, I will be with you in a jiffy.
Tut, 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 not so fast. I have not come for you. By no means.
You haven't?
No.
Then what are you doing here? And what do you mean by barging in here without even knocking?
Excuse me. I was in your neighborhood and all tired out after my day's work. And I thought I would drop in and sit around with you a while and cut up old scores. But I guess I owe you an apology at that for my entrance.
I should say you do.
Well, you see, I'm so accustomed to entering doors without knocking that I never thought. If you like, I will go outside and knock and not come in until you answer.
Look, you can get out of here and stay out of here, you bum.
There it is again. That same inhospitable note wherever I go. No one wants to chat with me. I'm so terribly lonesome. I thought surely you would like to punch the bag with me a while.
Another thing, what are you doing in that getup? You were supposed to be in black. You were supposed to look somber. Not like a Miami Beach winter tourist.
Why, I got tired of wearing my old working clothes all the time. Besides, I thought these garments would be more cheerful and informal for a social call.
Well, beat it. Just duffy out of here.
You need not fear me.
I do not fear you. But you are a knock to me among my neighbors. Your visit here is sure to get noised about and may cause gossip. You know you are not considered a desirable character by many persons. Although, mind you, I'm not saying anything against you.
Oh, go ahead. Everybody else puts the zing on me, so you might as well, too. But I do not think your neighbors will recognize me in white. Although, come to think of it, I notice everybody running to their front doors and grabbing in their welcome mats as I went past. But
Why are you shivering if you do not fear me?
I am shivering because of the clammy chill you brought with you. You lugged the atmosphere of a frigidaire around with you.
You don't tell me. I must correct that. I must take an electric pad with me. Do you think that is why I seem so unpopular wherever I go? Do you think I will ever be a social success?
I am inclined to doubt it. Your personality repels many persons. I do not find it as bad as that of some others I know. But you have undoubtedly developed considerable sales resistance to yourself in various quarters.
Do you think it would do any good if I hired a publicity man? I mean, to conduct a campaign to make me popular?
It might. The publicity men have worked wonders with even worse cases than yours. But see here, Death. I am not going to waste my time giving you advice and permitting you to linger on in my quarters to get me talked about. Kindly do a scramble, will you?
I am so lonesome.
Get?
Everyone is against me. Everyone.
Mr. Runyon.
Mm-hmm.
Aren't you asleep yet?
Oh. Where is he? Where did he go?
No one's here. It's way past visiting hours.
Past visiting hours?
Of course. You let me straighten your pillow. There.
I had a visitor.
What?
A fellow in soft white flannels. Death. He dropped in to see me, but he left. I thought he was going to take me with him. I wrote down what he said for my column. It's there in the typewriter.
Good night, Mr. Runyon.
Damon Runyon went into the operating room and came out without his voice. He came out smiling, but the wait had been too long, the illness too severe. The demon knew that night he saw the man in the white flannel suit. He faced death as bravely as any man I ever knew. And he faced it with the same humor that made his short stories known the world over. For the interview with Death, you have just heard, was there in Damon Runyon's typewriter. And it was published, and it became perhaps the most famous column he ever wrote. This shy, courageous little man, who no one really knew except his readers.
Of complications following his cancer operation 2 years later. Americans everywhere have honored his memory with the Damon Runyon Memorial Fund, remembering the brightness he brought into their lives with his writing. Well, Van Heflin, say, that was a wonderful performance you gave as Damon Runyon.
Well, thank you, Lionel. Runyon has always been a favorite author of mine, and I think time will prove those English critics right when they say that Runyon is as important to American literature as Thackeray is to theirs. But speaking of authors, we have another pretty famous one right here, the really wonderful biographer, Gene Fowler.
Never mind my writing, Van. Don't you think I'd make pretty good competition to the Barrymore clan as an actor?
Well, maybe. You stick to writing about the Barrymores. We'll do the acting.
Well, Lionel's certainly right about your writing, Gene. Your biography of John Barrymore, Good Night, Sweet Prince. That was really a wonderful book.
And don't forget Gene's minutes of the last meeting. Yeah, they tell me that's a bestseller. Well, Van and Gene, it's wonderful having you here.
Thank you, Lionel. It was really a pleasure to be on the Hallmark Hall of Fame with you, one of my oldest and, shall we say, dearest friends.
Well.
Lionel, what does Hallmark have for us next week?
Oh, next week we have a distinguished broadcast indeed, as we present an exciting episode from the life of Queen Victoria as Helen Hayes returns to star in the memorable role she made famous on Broadway as Victoria Regina.
We'll certainly want to hear that one.
Good night, Lionel.
Good night. Good night. next week, then, this is Lionel Barrymore saying good night.
That are sold only in stores that have been carefully selected to give you expert and friendly service. Remember, a Hallmark card when you carry enough to send the very best. Our producer-director is William Frew. Our transcribed script tonight by E. Jack Newman. Van Heflin appears through the courtesy of 20th Century Fox, whose current production is Three Coins and a Counting, in CinemaScope and Technicolor. Featured in our cast were Virginia Gregg, William Conrad, Polly Bear, William Johnstone, Jack Crucian, and Larry Thor. Remember the Hallmark Hall of Fame on television next Sunday when we present a stirring story from the life of Father Junipero Serra, founder of the California Mission. This is Frank Gross saying goodnight to you until next week at the same time when we'll present Miss Helen Hayes, starring in one of her most famous roles as Victoria Regina on the Hallmark Hall of Fame. This is the CBS Radio Network.
This is KMBC, Kansas City, Missouri.
The Hallmark Hall of Fame on Tuned to Yesterday, profiling Damon Runyon from May 16, 1954 on CBS. About 5 years earlier, film noir actor Alan Ladd's radio company, Mayfair Productions, produced better than 50 episodes of Damon Runyon's short stories known as the Damon Runyon Theater. And that wraps this hour of True History on Tuned to Yesterday. Be sure to be with us next time for more great programs from radio's yesteryear. Until our next hour together, I'm Mark LeVanier. Thanks for listening.